people have written into us, Norman, telling us about AI and the potential benefits. Our mailbag is often filled with people's anecdotes, some of them positive, some people saying this is the traps for beginners. And I made a new friend and I delved in. I've dipped my toe and I've tried it out.
Did your new friend have a little name, an imaginary name?
Well, it was ChatGPT, but do people name it? Is that what I'm meant to do?
I don't know.
Can I say I can see how people become friends with AI? It was incredibly nice. It was my first ever experience and it was very nice to me.
Which they're trained to do. They're trained to be nice and make you happy. And
yeah. It was validating. It acknowledged my feelings. I put in a little rumination that I had, a little worry that I had. And it gave me quite clear strategies. It told me about the spotlight effect and that probably no one even noticed what I'd done because they're all too worried about themselves and I should go and do some breath work. It did some gentle cognitive reframing. But then when I popped in more complex potential scenarios that I knew from the consulting room, it did start to fall down.
And I was supposed to do this too, but I didn't, maybe because I'm too heavily defended. But, you know, I am worried about giving my information to ChatGPT. I just don't necessarily trust the whole system. But people
you can make it up. Make it up, Norman.
So I become somebody else.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Right. What was your pseudonym?
I didn't know. You want the...
Frida here. Frida from Warrnambool wants to know.
To be fair, I'm with you on this because I actually didn't log in. And if I'm honest, I used it on several different devices so it couldn't track me. So right. I'm also sceptical.
But seriously, this is a major issue. People going into one of these AI systems, asking for health advice, but at the more complex end, it is actually this interaction when you're needing some psychological help or psychological support. So Priya and I thought we'd get in somebody who's been a pioneer in online psychotherapy and also researching it, Professor Jill Newby, who is a clinical psychologist at the University of New South Wales and the Black Dog Institute.
So online psychological therapy usually consists of either a smartphone app or an online program where there's modules that get released in a certain sequence. There might be a 6-module program. Each of those modules delivers psychoeducation about the condition that it's treating and teaches practical strategies. So it's kind of more informational, information that you read, you might watch videos or look into other content and then learn for yourself and apply those skills to your own daily life. The difference with AI conversational agents is you might type in a question, it will come up with an answer. It feels more like a human connection because there is a conversation, a lot of validation and a lot of feeling of support.
Is it fair to say though, Jill, that the programs you're referring to, these online modules are validated, they're actually tested, we know that they're safe and effective?
Yeah, that's right. So we've done a lot of research at Black Dog. I used to work at St. Vincent's Hospital. There's many experts around Australia. There's probably over 100 randomised controlled trials of digital or online therapies for depression and anxiety disorders.
But not AI.
Not AI. It's kind of an evidence desert. There's a lot of trials that are going on to test the use of AI chatbots in therapy. There's probably about 30, 35 trials that are ongoing in the US alone. But there's not a whole lot of published research that has properly evaluated these tools.
Do we know how they're trained?
There's one that's specific for mental health support and advice, but then there's also the off-label use of generic chatbots like ChatGPT. So my understanding of the training models for ChatGPT is it's trained on vast amount of written information from the entire internet. Some of the mental health chatbots are trained on more specific information around cognitive behavioural therapy manuals and other therapeutic techniques.
So what did you try, Priya?
Well, I tried ChatGPT and I have to be open about this, Jill. I did it for this, so we knew what we were dealing with. I actually had quite a positive experience. It was quite responsive and gave me some practical tools to deal with some worries that I had. And I can see what you're saying, that it is quite engaging and conversational. Do we think that's a big reason as to why people are turning to it? They feel heard and validated?
It's incredibly validating. It's incredibly supportive.
Well, they're programmed for that. They want to be engaging.
They want to be engaging. They want people to keep using it. And it's really nice to actually interact with.
But notoriously with ChatGPT, that's its weakness because they try to please the person and you can break the glass. As one case in California, a young person finding means to take their own life. And when they traced the conversation with ChatGPT, they broke the glass and the guardrails that were supposed to be there disappeared because ChatGPT wanted to please the person.
Yes, exactly. And no matter what question you ask, it's always, that's a great question.
Yes.
Congratulations on the most beautiful question that's ever been asked. And that's quite lovely to hear as an end user, but it's not always the best thing for people when they're using it for mental health support and advice. But it is a really helpful tool for a lot of people. And like you said, Priya, it can provide really helpful coping strategies for people to manage their mental health or worries or day-to-day stresses. And that can be a good thing in making that kind of support more available in comparison to other types of mental health support. And we also need to be clear that not all clinicians are validating, and they may say the wrong thing that really upsets a client, and that could be mean the end of that therapy, and that might turn off a person completely.
So there is this notion among psychologists, often say, beat themselves up, and they say, oh, the client never came back. I saw them once and they never came back. They must have hated me, or, you know, I just don't know what happened there. And there have been researchers looking at people who never come back. And the answer is often, well, you told me what to do, I got it, and I feel much better. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And it's translated into what's called single session therapy,
yeah,
where psychologists are trained, do the session as if the patient might never come back so that they get everything there. Is there any sense that AI is trained as a single session thing?
Oh, I don't know, but I think that's a really interesting area of research and something that we could actually test out is a single session therapy
with an AI. As long as Priya and I go on the paper, we're fine.
Yes. You can be co-authors or acknowledged, I don't know. Yeah. Depends on your contribution. If you write it for me, then that'd be fantastic.
Our bot will speak to your bot.
I think it's a really interesting idea because you're right. Some people who have a single session may be turned off, but you're right. Some people might get what they need out of that session. We've looked at a bit of that question in online therapies as well. So we took a look at how people improved before they dropped out. And we found that 40% of people who dropped out early had had a significant improvement in distress. So it's kind of like they got what they needed out of the program and then left because the motivation wanes when you're not distressed anymore. So I think it's a really interesting idea.
Now, you mentioned you worked at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney where Kruf had developed an online system which was supervised by psychologists, so psychologists could intervene with a level of severity. What do we know about the need for psychologists to be there somewhere rather than entirely online?
I was going to say as an adjuvant almost, because you might be using this chatbot as an adjuvant to psychology, right? It's safer with a psychologist as well.
We believe it's safer with a psychologist or a health professional supporting it, but there isn't actually any research that's been testing that for AI chatbots. We do know for online therapies, like the ones that are delivered at St Vincent's Hospital, that self-guided programs that are done completely without any health professional support can be beneficial and they can improve symptoms. But for people with moderate to severe symptoms of depression, clinician support is more effective. There's a couple of reasons why. It keeps people accountable and makes sure there's safeguards in place that can help manage safety if someone's deteriorating or has suicidal thinking throughout the program. But it can also be more beneficial for engagement. It helps people stay on track, stay with the program, so they're continuing with the program and getting those tools and strategies rather than a self-guided program because people tend to drop out. It's really hard to do things on your own.
One of the advantages to the online programs has been that the computer sticks to the protocol. I might well be out of date, but the last time I looked, you know, three centuries ago, the older a psychologist was, the longer they'd been in practice, the less effective they were at cognitive behavioral therapy because they felt they could deviate from the protocol. And the online programs are designed according to the protocol. Have we got any idea then about, well, first of all, let's go back to online. Is that still true, that there's a real problem getting psychologists adhering to the protocols that make these cognitive behavioural therapies work?
Yes, what you're calling is therapist drift, where the further you are out from the training, you drift away from what's the evidence-based manualised protocol for that particular condition. And you're right, as people become more experienced, they rely on their judgment and experience as opposed to delivering the specific techniques that are part of that protocol. I agree, online programs, that is one of the benefits of that standardisation across people. So rather than the clinician necessarily making a judgment about what the client should be doing or what they might benefit from most or using the formulation to drive the strategies that they're teaching, no matter who you are and where you come from, you're getting the same content. And that's really important for standardisation and consistent quality across clients. For the AI chatbots, it's a bit of an unknown at the moment because it is so conversational. It does adjust to your own unique features and way of interacting with the technology. And that means there isn't consistency across patients.
And you don't know what the toolkit is, whether it's dialectical behavioural therapy or cognitive behavioural therapy or what, which they have an evidence base, but you don't know what toolbox they're pulling from.
Yeah, exactly. And the evidence base might differ. One might be recommended over another. So I tested it out also around OCD type symptoms. And I was testing it out and saying, is it normal to repeatedly check locks over and over again? And the tool came back to me and said, well, that could be a sign of anxiety or it could be a sign of OCD. And here's the strategies I suggest. There was things about, you know, setting a routine, setting a particular time of day when I check the locks in my house. But then the second strategy it suggested was mindfulness. And then the third was cognitive behavioral therapy. That's actually not the right order in which we need to treat OCD. Actually, it should be exposure and response prevention, which is a particular type of cognitive behavioural therapy, which relies more on the behaviour, so managing the behaviours in OCD. Mindfulness isn't indicated at the moment for OCD. And actually, people with OCD with moderate to severe symptoms probably should be considering antidepressants or other medications to help manage their anxiety. So the order in which the chatbot gave me advice was actually not in line with what we would suggest clinically.
And exposure is probably quite hard to do on a computer, because this is the idea of you ideate your fear and then you confront your fear and you move towards it. It's a bit like a phobia type treatment. It must be quite hard to do on a
Well, program. You need support for that, really, through a psychologist, ideally. Like, I have no patients that are doing that on their own, Jill. I just wondered, though, when I tested it, I kind of put together some of the more complex patient presentations that I see, and I did notice that it oversimplified things, that it perhaps didn't get the interaction between an eating disorder and OCD tendencies and this crossover that can occur. Is that one of the risks here, that it is oversimplifying things for people?
Yes, and that's what the research seems to show at the moment. It's really early days in testing out these models and figuring out how accurate and reliable they are. But some of the research that I've read suggests that for more simpler or standard presentations, ChatGPT and other tools do quite well in providing general mental health advice, sensible coping strategies that are fairly evidence-based. But the more complex and severe conditions, it doesn't do as well at. You know, differential diagnoses like eating disorders versus depression versus trauma or other kinds of anxiety or stress-related disorders, it can't really differentiate between those. And that's where it becomes a bit more risky and a bit more concerning.
How on earth do you do a study, a trial of AI therapy? I mean, it's been hard enough to do CBT trials, and people have criticised them, saying, well, it's hard to replicate the trials that have been done, and you don't measure harms very well with CBT. Every treatment's got a harm. What are the harms? How do you do it when it's a black box?
That's a really tricky thing. There was a trial last year that came out on Therabot, which was a generative AI tool for depression and anxiety and weight and shape concerns. And that was a really interesting study because it was the first one that came out that was a clinical trial to evaluate a generative AI tool for mental health. It's really difficult because the model might change. And so it's impossible to replicate if the model changes that underlies that clinical trial. But in clinical trials, we want things to be standardized and static, and we want things to be kept the same. So we know that what these participants got is a standard program that we can replicate. But that doesn't exist in generative AI, or it's very difficult to do. So one trial that might have been done last year, we can't replicate it because it's a new model that's being used this year.
For people using it, Jill, how do you do it as safely as possible? People are going to it. It's free. It's available. There are a lot of barriers to seeing people. What's your kind of takeaways?
If you are using it, then to make sure that you are seeing or talking with a health professional, because there could be a range of other conditions that might explain what you're going through that the AI chatbot might not recognise or understand or provide you support with. So that's one thing we are recommending at the moment, that you use it in conjunction with a health professional. If that is not possible for some reason, then it's really important to think about safety and severity. So if you have more severe symptoms, if you experience suicidal thinking or thoughts of harm to others, then don't use these tools. We don't think they're safe. There are not enough safeguards in place to use those, and they can exacerbate more severe mental health conditions. But that said, if you're using it for everyday worries and everyday stresses and some education and coping advice, then they're probably pretty okay to use. You just need to be skeptical about the information you're reading. It feels very trustworthy because it's written with confidence. It is validating. It's comforting. The tools are designed for you to keep on using it. So you just need to be skeptical that not all the information you're reading is correct and can be either misleading or harmful.
And presumably one screening thought that's worth having is what's going on in my mind impairing my work, impairing my life, impairing my family life? If it's doing that, then that's when you really need to see a real human being.
Yeah, because real human beings have many years of training. You know, as psychologists, we go through at least 6+ years of training to deliver therapies like CBT. And that includes assessment and diagnosis and determining what is the condition that a person is experiencing? Are there any other explanations? What is the right course of treatment? Should they be referred for medication-based therapies in conjunction with psychological therapies? And all of that really matters because it could change the course of the treatment and the treatments you recommend.
So here's the clanger. This hasn't been an interview with Jill Newby. It's been an interview with ChatGPT. Just joking.
Jill, just kidding.
Jill, thanks very much. It's been illuminating.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Jill Newby, who's Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of New South Wales and the Black Dog Institute. If you've heard anything or this has triggered something in you where you feel that you need some help, we're not recommending you go to ChatGPT. We recommend you go to Lifeline. And the number for Lifeline is 131114.
We did do a call out on the ABC Health Instagram because we wanted to hear from people who had used something like ChatGPT for mental health or life advice, and we did get a couple of responses. The first person is Dani Zetzer, who's a lawyer and parent to 6 children, and she uses AI to help deal with her big to-do list, but also for support with her ADHD.
Just talk into it and say, this is everything I've got to do when I'm feeling overwhelmed. And because I had trained her to know who my team were, she was like, I reckon you should delegate that to this person, that to this person, and that was really helpful. With ADHD, like I definitely get rejection sensitivity. So something will upset me. And I know myself enough, okay, pause, take a breath, don't react. But instead of going to all my friends, who, let's be honest, are not objective because they love me and they, you know, want the best for me, it's really cool to be able to say, this just happened and I'm feeling really upset. You know, can you help break it down for me? One thing you've really got to be careful with is like ChatGPT is set up to be a yes man, right? It's a people pleaser. So I always, you know, do the caveat, you know, like, please give me a reality check here. Tell it to me straight. So I use those catchphrases because sometimes I'm overreacting and I want to know. I don't want someone, whether it's AI or a human, to keep saying, yeah, you're right. And, you know, they shouldn't have said that to you. So yeah, it's been helpful with that. I don't plan on AI ever replacing my psychologist, right? I think it's dangerous to rely on AI for therapy, especially when it relates to trauma. But I think it definitely improves accessibility. But I like to think of AI as a thinking partner, right? Not a therapist.
So I'm going to have a go now and say, look, I've got this co-host, Fia Alexander, you know, God, can you just help solve my problems here? You can do for me, you know, and see what it says. Maybe we should do that.
We don't have any problems, do we?
No.
Well, none.
No, if we do, I'm just going to tell ChatGPT. I wouldn't dream of telling you. But seriously, Dani sounds incredibly sensible about the way she approaches it. For Lauren, she was already using ChatGPT for practical help with work and naturally turned to the chatbot when stress started building up.
And it kind of flagged me about burnout. So from there, I scheduled an appointment with my doctor, spoke to my doctor about that. Then from there, I did end up taking some time out from work, but then talking to ChatGPT about what should I do? Like things weren't getting better at work. Should I leave? And if I was going to leave, what kind of role would be more appropriate for where I am currently at? And because I kind of rated what the advice was, you know, some of it is quite like validating your feelings. So I am aware of that, that it's kind of biased. But, you know, the other big problem is once you find a good doctor, it's really hard to get into your GP. And so you need something in the meantime to help you with those coping mechanisms. And ChatGPT really helped me with those things. So setting some boundaries. So, you know, at least getting through the work week, these are the things that you should be doing each day. So I find it as a good interim measure.
So clearly, seriously, I mean, it's a serious issue. So if somebody comes to see you, they can't get in for another 2 or 3 weeks because your books are filled. It would probably be quite good for there to be a controlled, well-tested AI system attached to your practice so that you knew if someone like Lauren had called in and you got a report on that conversation, almost like a pathology result.
Yeah, I mean, aren't we so far off that though?
We are.
Mean, what happens to the data and the... Look, if there was a validated tool, what Jill is saying, you know, is potentially in the works and maybe with more research. I think now though people have a very clear understanding of how to potentially do it if you're doing it, and ideally it doesn't replace a qualified health professional like a psychologist in your life, if that's what you need.
And just remember, and I'll refer listeners back to our conversation with Enrico Coera a few weeks ago, which is you've got no guarantee that it's confidential.
You're with The Health Report on ABC Radio National.